But we're going to go from James chapter 1, verse 1, all the way through verse 18. Now, if you are to read verse 1 all the way through 18, you would probably read it and go, man, James is talking about like four separate topics in a very short amount of time. And that's why I like James, because I think James thinks like me. If you've ever listened to any of my sermons or had a personal conversation with me, I'm a little bit of a rabbit trail kind of person. I get off. And you might think to yourself, man, Mitch is like, he's talking about five separate things. No. I'm talking about one thing, but I'm talking about the five different aspects that come up in my mind as I'm talking about that one thing. You can call it ADHD. I don't label myself like that. You can call it whatever you want. I don't call myself ADHD. But I think James is kind of the same way. Because you're looking at this and you're going, man, James is talking about like four different topics here. No, he's not. He's talking about one thing. From verse 1 to 18, he has one thing on his mind, and that's spiritual maturity. What does spiritual maturity look like? How do we gain spiritual maturity? And what do we do when that becomes challenging? And so the four things that he's hitting on that we're going to look at today, we're going to kind of separate it into four sections. It's trials, wisdom, trust, and tests. Tests, like you take a test at school, tests. Trials, wisdom, trust, and tests. So let's jump to the first section talking about trials. So James 1:1, let's just read from there to verse 4. James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes in the dispersion, greetings. Verse 2, man. Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds. For you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness, and let steadfastness having its full effect that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. We are two verses in, and James hits us with one of the most challenging, right between the eyes verse. Count it all joy. You got to count it all joy when you're going through suffering and trials. But I think sometimes we misunderstand that, and we think that it means we're supposed to be joyful about the trials we go through. You see those Christians sometimes, they're like, yep, got in a car accident and insurance won't pay for it, but praise God. You're like, yep. They said the damage is permanent. They got to take it off from the knee down, but praise God. And you're like, that's not what James is saying. James is, or you know, those Christians who are clearly having a bad day and you're like, are you okay? And they're like, oh, praise God. 6 feet above ground, doing well. James is not asking us to like fake happiness. He's not saying to pretend like the trials that you're going through aren't real. He's saying that we count it all joy because it's producing something in us. We're not celebrating the trial. We're celebrating the fact that it's doing something in us. What is it doing in us? He says, the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. So steadfastness is not one of those words that we use very often. It's probably the only time you'll see it today is in the Bible. But it's the Greek word hypomone, that literally means to remain underneath. It's this concept of like maintaining pressure or holding something up. It's like the foundation of your house holding the weight of the structure. It's like a bridge holding the weight of the cars going across it. It's like you putting on a big backpack as you hike. You're remaining under that pressure. That's what it's talking about. It makes me think of my favorite tool in my garage, an air compressor. I love air compressors. I'm like a fiend for making sure tires are pumped up. But I got tired because Bree and I both have a car. And man, I would check them like every morning, especially when it's cold outside. But then I'd have to drive to a gas station to find one of the little air machines. And inevitably, it's broken or I don't have any quarters or it just doesn't work at all. You know, it's just like, ugh. So finally I broke down and I'm like, I'm getting an air compressor. So I got me one of them little pancake air compressors. Like I think it's a Black & Decker. I don't know. I got it on sale. I've got it in my garage on the shelf. Like it's on display. I love that thing. And my mother-in-law came to our house last week because her and Bree were going to a conference and she left her car in our garage. And I opened the garage to take the trash out and I looked at that front left tire and I said, mm-mm. I've got an eye for it. I can tell whether you got low air pressure just by looking at you, okay? I know, I'm like, I see it. I said, that tire's low. So I went and got my little tire gauge. I went and checked it. Sure enough, 3 PSI too low. 3 PSI. I said, nuh-uh, not in this house. Ain't nobody riding below the standard limit, okay? So I went and got my air compressor. I plugged it in. Took me 5 seconds. Put that bad boy back on the shelf. But then anybody who has an air compressor, what do you need to do before you put it away? turn it off. That's true. Hunter's right. You do need to turn it off. Don't let it run. But there also is a release valve on the bottom. You should always release that excess pressure. You don't want it to build up condensation. You don't want it to hurt the seals and everything. You want to release that pressure. So our walk with the Lord, this process of sanctification, you know, it feels like pressure, right? When you're growing, it feels like pressure. And I think oftentimes when we're walking with the Lord, we're looking for him to relieve pressure. We're saying, Lord, please take this away. Lord, make this easier. Lord, make my boss get lost somewhere on the way to work today. You know, we're trying to get the Lord to take things away from us. You know, but the process of sanctification, the process of growth in our life, is not about God installing more release valves on your life. Maybe instead of installing more areas of relief, maybe he's trying to make you able to withstand that pressure better. Maybe he wants you to become a structure that can actually hold on to that pressure and utilize it for good. You know, my dad a couple years ago bought a big old Chevy truck with big aftermarket tires on there. And he came out of the driveway one day and I was like, those tires are low. Because I know. I could smell them from the house. I said, them tires are low. And he's like, all right. So he goes to Harbor Freight and he buys like the smallest, tiniest air compressor you can get. It looks like a 2-liter Coke bottle. He brings it home and he plugs it in. He lets it build up pressure and he goes to put air in his tire in his truck. And the air compressor is so weak that the pressure from the tire is pushing air into the air compressor rather than the other way around. And it's like, well, what's the point of that? An air compressor that can't push back against the external pressure is kind of useless. There's no point in having it. And so if we spend our life trying to just open more release valves on us, we can't hold that pressure. We end up being good for nothing. And so what we need to realize is that we're built to withstand that pressure. Part of sanctification is teaching you to withstand that pressure so that when external pressures push against you, you have something to push back against with. You're going to have fear come into your life. You need to push back with trust. You're going to have anger push back. You're going to have to push back with peace. But that takes time. And if you're still just a little baby air compressor, it's going to take time for you to grow so that you can push back against those things. Do you remember last week we talked about James and Paul and we were making the comparison like, oh, are they saying two different things? And we realized that no, they're saying the exact same thing. They're just two different sides of the same coin, right? Okay, so James says, count it all joy when you face trials of various kinds because it produces steadfastness. Let's see what Paul says about it in Romans 5, 3 through 4. Paul says, not only that, but we rejoice in our sufferings. Sounds pretty similar. Why? Knowing that the suffering produces endurance. So James says steadfastness, Paul says endurance. Guess what the Greek word is? It's the same, hypomone. They say the exact same thing. They're both saying, hey, you need to count it all joy when you're facing trials and suffering. Why? Because it's producing something in you, the ability to endure. It's two different wordings, but it's the exact same outcome. And Paul takes it even further. He says, not only that, but your endurance is then going to produce character. And that character is going to produce hope. Nobody you know in life who you respect has had an easy life. Nobody who runs a successful business, nobody who you respect spiritually, nobody who you look up to and ask advice has had an easy life. They have faced trials, and those trials have produced endurance, and that endurance has produced character. And that character then has produced hope so that they can feed that hope back into us. Nobody that you respect has had an easy life, so why would you want the same for yourself? You don't want to be that valve that's continuously open, leaking air, relying on everybody else. At some point, you want to be able to stand up and push back against the pressure yourself. Amen? Okay, so we're going to face trials, and we have to be happy about that because it's going to do something in us. But what about when we face these trials and we don't know what to do? What about when we're confused? Let's look at verses 5 through 8. James says, if any of you lacks wisdom, meaning you don't know what to do, he says, let him ask God who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given to him. Now that's a promise. That's crazy. James is saying, if you don't know what to do, all you have to do is ask God, and he will give it to you. God does not give stingily. God's not like, well, we'll see how I feel today. It's like, if you ask God for wisdom, he will give it to you. He gives freely. He gives generously. But there's a caveat. He says, but let him ask in faith with no doubting. For the one who doubts is like the wave of the sea and is driven and tossed by the wind. For that person must not suppose he will receive anything from the Lord, for he is double-minded and unstable in all his ways. Man. So James is saying, if you need it, you ask and you will get it. But when you ask, you need to make sure that you're trusting what you're getting. So the question is not really, do I know what to do? The question is, when you ask God, do you trust that he'll give you? And when he gives it to you, are you going to be obedient with what he gives you? Because that's really the problem. Because we know that he will. So if we know that he will, it's no longer, let me make sure I'm in the right position and I've prayed the right prayer and make sure that I've asked the right way and I've got the incense burning so that God will listen. No, God will listen and will give you the answer. The problem is us. Is when you hear it, will you hold it faithfully? Let me illustrate this with two stories. I had a buddy in high school and college who had a truck and his gas gauge didn't work. And it wasn't just like it sat at E either. It like bounced around. Like it would just do this the whole time. And it freaked me out. So we'd be in the truck and I'm like, hey man, like, I'm leaning over. I'm like, do we need to get gas? He's like, no, I'm good. He had driven that truck so long, he just started keeping track of how many gallons he had in the tank, how many miles he had driven. So he just knew when he needed to fill up. He never ran out. Never once did I have to pick him up. He just knew. Now, why he didn't just fix the gas gauge? I don't know. It costs money. It's easier just to remember. I don't know. But then I was driving his truck one day, and we were about to drive kind of in a space of Georgia where it's like, we're going to be like in the middle of nowhere for a minute. Like it'd be driving like from here to College Station. Like we'd be driving through Shiro. You know, I don't know if we're going to hit a gas station or not. And so I'm looking at the gas gauge and it's just sitting on empty. It's not even bouncing around. And so in my mind, I'm thinking that seems like it's empty to me, right? So I'm telling him like, hey man, like, I think we should probably get some gas. He's like, no, trust me. We got plenty of gas. We're going to make it. And I'm like, man. I was like, look, I know this is your truck. I know you know better than me. I know you've been driving this truck for years. I still feel like it would make me more comfortable if maybe we would stop and get some gas. And he was like, dude, I'm telling you, there's plenty of gas in the truck. We're going to make it there. I promise you. And I'm like, can I just pay for the gas? Can we still stop? And he's like, dude, you do whatever you want. So I'm like, okay, so there's a gas station right before we leave town. We pull over, get out of the truck, I get the nozzle and open the thing and put the thing in there, start pumping the gas, and it clicks off at about 450. And I'm like, okay. So I put the thing back, I get in the truck, and he's just looking at me like, I'm like, okay, you're right, okay. It was basically full. He didn't tell me that he filled up before he picked me up, but you know. But what happened? I wasted time, I wasted money, and I was wrong. And I refused to trust the person who actually knew what was going on, who had the gauge up here. But no, I was too busy concerned with my own perception of what I could see and what I could feel and what made me comfortable. Okay, so that's my one friend with the truck. And let me tell you about another friend I had. And I don't want to tell you his real name because I'm about to talk trash about him. So let's say his name is Steven, okay? So Steven, honestly, one of my favorite friends in college. He was so funny. He's almost as funny as me. He is funny. He's like just fun to be around. Like he was just such a kind guy. He's one of those guys that like everybody gets along with Steven. He's just fun. But he's the biggest flake you've ever met in your life. Like you couldn't rely on him for anything. He's gonna be late to his own funeral. Like the man does not know how to keep tabs on when he's supposed to be somewhere. So he used to work at this wings place and we were gonna have a party at our house and we said, Steven, when you get off work, will you bring a tray of wings? And he was like, yeah, for sure, man. So the party starts at like 6. It's like 8 o'clock. People are like, hey, where's the food? Like I'm hungry. And I text Steven, I'm like, Steven, where are you at? And he's like, I couldn't make it. I'm like, are you still at work? He's like, no, I left. I'm like, okay. So we had to like order pizza or something. Another time, and I'm just telling you three instances of like 13, okay? So another time we tell Steven, we're all going to the movies. All of our friends, there's like 15 of us. I'll buy your ticket, just show up because he was working. So he was gonna show up late. I'm like, I'll buy your ticket. So we go to the movies, we sit in the movies, we're eating popcorn, we're watching whatever movie we're watching. We get out of the movies, we're all staying in the parking lot and we're like, wait a minute, where's Steven? I text Steve, where are you? Oh, I couldn't make it. I just bought your ticket. You can't even show up. And then the third time with Stephen, I think this was the final straw moment. I was in a band and we had to go play a show. Me and my roommate were the guitarist and the bassist. So we drive to the venue. My drummer is getting a ride. Who does he get a ride from? Yeah. We get to the venue. I text Kale, our drummer. And I'm like, Kale, where are you? He's like, Stephen never showed up to pick me up. So we have to drive back to our house to pick up Kale to go back to the venue, and we're late. And finally, we're just like, you know what? We're not asking Stephen to come anywhere anymore. Stephen's not invited because we know he's not just going to show up anyway. So what's the point? So we just kind of gave up on Stephen. Like, I'm not even asking him. The question is, with those two stories, how are you treating God? Which one of those friends are you treating God like? Are you treating God like, because here's the thing, we all have people in our lives who have failed to show up, who promised they were going to be somewhere and they weren't, promised they're going to come through and they didn't, promised they would be there for us and they left. And so many of us probably have this stigma inside of us that's like, in order to avoid disappointment, because my life has been so full of it, I'm not going to ask God for anything. I would just rather not ask at all. I'll just grin and bear it and call it good. Or there's those of us who ask God and desire to have him answer us, but then when we receive the answer, we go, it's not really the answer I wanted. Based on my perception, that's not really what needs to happen. Which one are you? Are you treating God like he's the flaky friend? Or is every time you ask him for something, it doesn't meet your criteria, so you just kind of move on to the next thing? Because here's the reality. God has never been the flaky friend. He's never been the one not to show up. He's always the guy in the truck who knows exactly how much gas is in the tank. We just keep doubting him because we're so concerned with our own perception that we can't bring ourselves to trust him. And so James is telling us, if you're like that, you're like the wave of the sea. You're not trustworthy either. I mean, how would you feel if somebody comes, and this has happened before, people come to me and they say, Mitch, I have this problem. I just don't know what to do. And I'm like, well, I think you should do this. And they go, yeah, I don't want to do that. I'm like, why are you asking me then? What's the point? If you're seeking wisdom and then you don't want to follow it, what's the point of asking for it in the first place? Because I think deep down what we really want is we just want our agenda to be met and we want God to put his stamp of approval on it. That's really what you want. You don't really want to hear from the Lord. You want to keep going all along your own path and you want God to keep giving you green lights all along the way so you don't have to change. That's really what you want. And so God will speak to you. Thankfully, God won't treat us like I treated Stephen. You know, we eventually were just like, I'm not talking to Stephen anymore. Thankfully, God doesn't treat us that way. God will continuously treat, no matter how many times you flake on him, no matter how many times he gives you instructions and you ignore it, he will never cut you off. That's the beautiful thing. He will continue to speak to you, even in our rebellion, even in our neglect. He will continue to speak to you. The thing is, you first and foremost, you need to understand he speaks to you through his word. There are things in here that are already written that give you instruction. I had somebody tell me one time, like, yeah, I know I should probably forgive this person, but I'm just waiting on a word from the Lord. And I'm like, it's here. Ephesians 10, it says, forgive those, do it. There's no need for you to go in your closet and be like, Lord, should I? Yes, it says it right here. You don't need to wait on this giant revelation for the Lord to do the basic stuff. Forgive them, period. You don't need to wait on that. But also, as you read his word, this is not simply an instruction manual. This is telling you about a person. This is a person that you can have a relationship with. You need to have a personal relationship with the Lord, because at some point you no longer need to ask for every little thing. You'll know his character. I think I've told y'all before. When I was a kid, my friends wanted to take frozen burritos and go throw them at a stop sign. Now, I did not call my mom and ask her if I thought that was okay, because I knew what the answer was. I didn't need to call my mom and know if she thought it was okay if I went and threw frozen burritos at stop signs. I knew her character enough to know the answer to that question. And so part of being in your word on a continuous basis is that you learn God's character to where you don't have to worry about every single decision. John Piper makes this joke about, you know, you go to the grocery store and you're like, okay, Lord, it's time to pick out orange juice. Pulp or no pulp, tell me. Don't interrupt me. hold on. I'm in the middle of something, ma'am. Could you please not push me out of the way? Lord, tell me, pope or no pope, I'll sit here as long as you want me to. You don't have to go that way. One, like, I don't think God cares. Pope is better, and we all know that, okay? And so, it's just the natural way. When you squeeze an orange, there's pope in it. I don't know. But also, when you understand God's character, you don't have to worry about every single little decision. You start knowing his word, and you start knowing his character to where you know how to respond. Because you know him. You have to have a personal relationship with him. The only way you can do that is to know him, and the only way you know him is through his word. Amen. Period. Okay? Okay. So that's trust in the middle of trials. And then as we get to verses 9 through 12, James seemingly takes like this wild left turn because he starts talking about money all of a sudden. And it would seem out of place, but in reality, James talks about money because money is one of the places that we will feel the most temptation in our life as a believer. Let's go through 9 through 12 and I'll tell you what I mean. Verse 9. Let the lowly brother boast in his exaltation and the rich in his humiliation, because like a flower of the grass, flip, he will pass away. For the sun rises with its scorching heat and it withers the grass. Its flower falls and its beauty perishes. So also will the rich man fade away in the midst of his pursuits. Blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial, for when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life, which God has promised to those who love him. And so he's saying that the lowly man or the poor man should be glorified in the fact that he'll be lifted up. And he says the rich man or the high man should be glorified in the fact that he'll be humiliated, which is not the negative connotation that we have, but brought low, humbled, maybe is a better way to say it. And the reason he says that is because the wealth that both of them rely on will fade like a flower in the grass, meaning like it'll be burnt up. You know, when we have droughts here, you just see the way the grass burns up, it crumbles, it dissipates. Because even in, whether you've got $5 in your bank account or you've got $5 million, both of those can disappear like that. And all of a sudden, that security that you hope for is gone. Because wealth, or the lack thereof, is one of the greatest temptations we can face. Because poverty, or having a lack, will tempt you to covet what you don't have. And wealth will tempt you to worship what you do have. Both are bad. Being impoverished and constantly desiring that which you don't have puts your trust in something other than God. Being wealthy and feeling like that's your source of security and trusting in the wealth to bring you security is also shifting your focus away from trusting God. Both of them are bad. And so, you know, on a air compressor, there's a gauge that reads how much PSI, which is pounds per square inch. It tells you how much air is inside of it, right? Be very easy for you to look at an air compressor with 5 PSI and be like, man, that thing's worthless. Versus if you see one that's got 150 PSI, you're like, no, that's what I want. Well, here's the thing. An air compressor that only has 5 pounds per square inch, but it's plugged into the wall, is a lot more valuable than an air compressor that has 150 PSI that has no power source around. Because the one plugged into the power source, you can just turn it back on and more will come, okay? More will be put into it. An air compressor with 150 PSI and no power source, that's where you start getting in trouble, because when you're not plugged into the source, I don't care how nice your air compressor is, how much money you spend on it, they all leak. Very slowly, but they all leak. And so if you're trusting in that reading on that gauge more than you're relying on the source that you're plugged into, you are eventually going to be left empty regardless. Your trust cannot lie on the gauge. It has to rely on the fact that you're plugged in. Because if you're plugged into the source, it doesn't matter if you have 5 or 50 or 150. You're plugged into the source and you'll be given all that you need. That's what James is bringing up. And that's why he's talking about money, because it's just one of those sneaky little things. Because again, people are like, oh yeah, money's the root of all evil. No, no, no. That's not what scripture says. It's the love of money that is the root of all evil. And the love of money can exist whether we are lowly or whether we're up high. Lowly, and you love money so much, you're like, I just want to get more, I just want to get more, I just want to get more. That's what's going to bring me security. Or if you're up here and you're sitting high and you say, oh, I love money. It's what brings me security, what makes me feel safe. Both are wrong because that money can disappear like that. That's not your security. We are given money to steward well. And that's what he's talking about in verse 12 is like, those who endure to the end will be given the crown of life. It doesn't matter if God has given you 5 PSI, 50 PSI, 100 PSI. It's how you are stewarding it, making sure you're connected to the source and doing with it as he has called you to. Okay? And so, don't be tempted to trust in that gauge. You make sure that you're plugged into that source. And so if our wealth is something that can quietly shift our trust from God, what do we do when we're met with actual trials and temptations? That's what we're talking about in verse 13 through 18. Jump with me there. 13 through 18. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire, when it has conceived, gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death. Do not be deceived, my beloved brothers. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change. For his own will he brought us forth by the word of his mouth, that we should be the kind of first fruits to all creatures. So James is making a very sharp distinction. He's like, do not say that God tempts you. God does not tempt anyone, right? Temptation comes from our own desire. Temptation is that I want to be loved. I want to be liked. I want to be secure. I want to be whatever. Those are not bad within themselves, but those are the things that lead us into temptation. You know, it's the, you want to be loved. And maybe like marriage at home is difficult, but then there's that person at the office who gives you attention. And you want to lean into that because the temptation is, ooh, I want to be loved and this person's giving me attention, right? It starts off good. It's a good intention, but that temptation leads to sin. And so as you start thinking about that and you start ruminating on it, it says it gives birth to sin. And then the sin, as it's given full birth, gives forth death. And you see the natural cause of that. You know, if you have an affair in your office, you bring forth death, not only to your marriage, but also to your spiritual life. I mean, that's what James is talking about is the temptation is in here. It already exists in here. But God does test you. There's a difference. And the easiest way I can think about it is God is going to test you in order to make you grow, but your own desires tempt you to fail that test. And think about it like you're taking a math test at school. I know, forgive me, all of my illustrations, I was a teacher for 10 years, lots of illustrations with education. Think about being in a room, you're taking a test, and you're like, man, this is difficult, but like here, we're making my way through it. And then you look over at your buddy next to you, who you know has got the right answers. And there's that temptation like, oh man, I could cheat. Because if I cheated, then I get a good grade. My teacher would be proud of me. I'd be proud of myself. People would think I'm smart. Do you see where the temptation starts? It's good. Like you want to impress people. You want to be successful. You want to be proud of yourself. You want other people to be proud of you. But then those are the very desires that get twisted to the point of being tempted to do it the wrong way. Because ultimately, if you cheated, you didn't learn anything. You stole from your friend. I know people don't see cheating like that, but it is. You're absolutely stealing from somebody. You're stealing from somebody. And then also, you're a disappointment because you're giving off a false grade. You're giving off a false rating to yourself. You're lying. I mean, that's ultimately what happens. And that's what happens when we're tempted is like, we think, oh, it's just a little thing. But no. It leads down a road. It gets easier and easier and easier to do that very thing. And so let's talk about an instance where God is testing somebody and then temptation shows up in the middle of it. The best example I can think of in the Bible, one of my favorite stories, is the story of Joseph in Genesis. So if you don't know, Joseph, he's one of many brothers and he's kind of the favorite. The dad even gives him a special jacket and he starts having these dreams. And he tells his brothers about these dreams. And in these dreams, he's saying, yeah, I'm having these dreams where like, I'm standing in the middle of a field and all of you are like bowing down to me. And he has a couple of these and his brothers is like, all right, that's enough. like I don't want to hear my little brother telling me he's having dreams about me bowing down to him. So his brothers get frustrated, pretty frustrated, to the point where they stage his own death. So they take his cloak, his jacket, his special coat, and they cover it in blood. They bring it to their father, and they're like, look, Joseph was killed by an animal. Look what happened to him. Their father's distraught. All the while, what actually happened is they took him and they sold him into slavery. So he's in Egypt, and he's a slave. And so he didn't choose that, right? Like, Joseph didn't choose to be a slave. He was forced into that. And then, as he's in Egypt, he's falsely accused of a crime. He's thrown in prison. He didn't choose that. That's just happening to him. And then while he's in prison, he helps out somebody. And that he says, hey, when I get out of here, I'm gonna put in a good word for you because you helped me. He gets out of prison and, oh, he forgets. Joseph spends another 2 years in prison. And then finally, he's released. So he's been enslaved, he's been falsely imprisoned, he's been lied to and spends more time in prison than he really should have. Now he's in one of the elite houses of the Empire of Egypt. He's in Potiphar's house. Potiphar is one of the higher-ups in the Egyptian hierarchy, and he's a servant in Potiphar's house. Well, he's doing pretty well. Like, he becomes the head servant. He's telling everybody what to do. But while he's in Potiphar's house, Potiphar's wife starts making eyes at Joseph. Potiphar's wife's like, I like that Israelite tan you got there. You know, she starts wearing high slit dresses. She forgets to button that top button. She's flirting with Joseph like day after day. And she's like, hey, Joseph, like we should sleep together. Now, think about this. Think about how temptation works. Joseph has been sold into slavery by his brothers. He's been thrown into prison under false accusations. He's been forgotten and left there for 2 years. I bet you Joseph had this yearning in his heart to be loved, to be wanted, to be seen. And all of a sudden, there's a woman who was willing to let him be seen and wanted and loved. And so you know there's temptation within Joseph to say yes to that, to agree to that. But because of the trials he's gone through, because of the endurance that's been built up amongst those trials, he now has the character to withstand that external pressure. It says she snatches him one day. Potiphar's wife just gets tired of asking him. She grabs him by the clothes. He strips off his shirt and he runs. He runs away. He's like, far from me. But he says in Genesis 39, 7 through 12, he says, oh, I'm sorry, 39, 9. He says, how then could I do this great wickedness and sin against God? Notice where his focus is. It's not on his own gauge. He's not talking about what he thinks he deserves, what he feels. He's looking to God and he's saying, no, Lord, you've brought me through all of these other things. Why would I now sin against you? Why would I now look to my own interest when you have brought me through so much? So Joseph does not give in to temptation because he places his trust in the right place, in the Lord. He's making sure that he's plugged into that source more so than being worried about the gauge that he's reading. And so if you want to be able to withstand that external pressure, you have to go through trials. It's going to happen. You have to be able to build that endurance and that character. Think about it like this. When I first moved into our house in Huntsville, we had new sod, right? And I wanted to make sure I didn't kill it. So I asked my neighbor, Mr. Rusty, who's a gardener. It's like his hobby. I was like, all right, Rusty, I've got this automatic sprinkler timer. So should I just water the grass like every day, like 15 minutes? And he's like, absolutely not. Don't do that. I'm like, why? Don't you want to give it regular water? He's like, no, absolutely not. It's the worst thing you can do for it. I was like, okay, explain. Help me understand. Okay, you got grass, right? And it's got a little bitty root sticking below the ground. It's like when you water every day, you're just giving that root a little bit more water, a little bit more water, a little bit more. But he's like, the second you stop, let's say you lose water, or let's say we're not allowed to water because there's a drought or something. The second you stop watering every day, that grass gets thirsty quick. And if you don't keep watering it every day, you miss a couple days, that root has nowhere to get water, and all of a sudden that grass dries up and it dies. He's like, here's what you need to do. You water it once a week, Saturday morning, like 4 a.m., and you water it for like an hour, just a bunch of water. I was like, okay. He's like, because what's going to happen is you're going to water it on Saturday, bunch of water is going to come running down, and that grass is going to be like, delicious water. I love water. Chlorophyll and what's it called? Photosynthesis. Thank you, Tina. All that stuff's happening. The sun comes up Sunday morning. It's like, oh, no water today, but that's okay. I still got some water. Monday morning comes. Slowly yet surely, Sunday comes. The water gets lower in the ground. Tuesday, lower. Wednesday, lower. All of a sudden, the water level is lower than the root. What does the grass have to do? It's forced to grow. It has to. It has to shoot its roots deeper. It has to grow stronger to push through all of that dirt and clay in order to reach the water that's down below it. And so it forces the grass to actually grow. And yeah, on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, that grass might be getting hit by that sun and it's like, ah, I'm about to burn up. I don't know how much more I can take. And then Friday, it's thinking, I'm going to die. I can't take another day of this. But then Saturday comes and boom, you give it all that water back, right? It refreshes it. That's what we need. The heat may feel like it's about to kill that grass, but a good gardener knows exactly how much heat it can take before it needs to get watered again. And you might feel that same way. In your life, it might be Monday and Tuesday, and you're like, man, I need some water. Like, I'm thirsty. Or for you, it might be Friday night, and you're like, I am going to die. I need relief now. Or you might feel like an air compressor, and you're like, you're coming up on too high of a PSI, you're over in the red, and you're like, I'm about to explode if I don't find some relief. But I need you to understand something. In order for you to grow, you have to have that pressure. And it's not that difficult of a concept. Think about going to the gym. You don't go to the gym and every time you show up, you take off more weight. You put on more weight, right? Yeah, God is teaching you. The load is not getting lighter. Your back is getting heavier. I mean, your back is getting stronger. Said that like 5 times. I messed it up on Sunday morning. What the heck? Yeah, the load is not getting lighter. Your back is getting heavier. You don't show up to the gym and you're like, oh man, I can't wait to do less than I did last time. No, you're trying to do more. You want to get stronger. You want to push more weight. Let's look at 1 Corinthians 10:13. It says, no temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man, which means nothing you're going through, nothing is uncommon to man. Nothing that the humanity has never experienced. You are not unique, which should be an encouragement. I know we all want to be special, but when it comes to suffering, know that you are not alone. There's nothing you're going through that God hasn't seen, that other people haven't seen. You are not alone in your suffering. And it says, God is faithful and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability. But with the temptation, he will also provide a way of escape that you may be able to endure it. God knows exactly how much sun you need and how much of it you can take before you need water again. And he's never once been late in providing it. Think about that. He's never once been late. You've been in times where you're like, I don't know how much more I can take. Just a little bit more. And he is faithful to provide exactly what you need. That's what spiritual maturity looks like. That's what James is talking about in these verses, is that maturity is not the absence of pressure, but growth underneath that pressure. So I want you to think of something you're going through right now. Think about one of those things that, you know, like my dad's air compressor. You're putting it on the tire, but it's just pushing back. What is one thing you're going through right now that's pushing back against you?